They're off.
This week I'm going to be racing the Skedaddle in Canterbury, and I'm going to be wearing my Big Bronco race vest, which I love and I've raved about for months. If you don't know Ultraspire, check him out, www.ultraspire.nz. Bryce Thatcher's been making the most incredible packs for the last 40 something years, and my god, I am stoked. I've got a ton of compulsory kit to wear, and not to wear, hopefully to carry, and it's all fitting in there, plus everything I need, race nutrition, bottles, the lot. So yeah, check them out, www.ultraspire.nz, and my favourite, the Big Bronco.
Currans, C-U-R-R-A-N-Z, by the way, the little New Zealand black currants, their ace. Head along to Currans, as I said, currans.co.nz, to read up on the science behind these little pills that help with the recovery. And if you use the code DIRTCHURCH, you get 20% off your first order of Currans 30s. Give it a crack.
Did you know, Eugene, we are so close to actually being inside Further Faster that I can taste it. I can taste the down jackets, the kayaks, I can taste the coffee, I can taste the bouldering chalk, I can taste all of it, I can smell it, I've been visualizing it. The best independently owned outdoor store in the known universe, 57A Buchan Street, Sydenham, Otutahi, Christchurch, or hit them up at furtherfaster.co.nz. So excited.
Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Oh, Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Dirt Church Radio.
Episode 274 of the Dirt Church Radio podcast. I'm Matt Raymond.
And I am Eugene Bingham. Tēnā koutou katoa. We made it.
We did indeed, sir.
Holy heck.
How are you?
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Great episode.
What are you excited about?
I'm just so excited. I'm so excited.
Anything else you're excited about?
Oh, life. Why wouldn't you be? Yeah. What about you? Are you excited?
I'm pretty damn excited. I'm excited to finish work. I'm excited to go down to Christchurch. And I'm excited to, right now, on Dirt Church Radio, walk something back. Do you want to...
Yeah,
get into that.
Yeah, because, you know, we need to deal with something. If you listened to our DCR Aid Station episode last week or the bonus episode on Saturday, you'll have heard that one, Matt Raymond, made a certain commitment in respect of our heading over to the New South Wales Far East Ferber Climb in the Blue Mountains on August 30 and 31, a fundraiser for motor neurons disease research. Yeah, have you got anything to say for yourself, Matt Raymond of Riverhead?
Well, it's fair to say that I got swept up in the emotion of the moment, and when Gavin said that if he could find someone $10,000 to donate $10,000, would you run up and down the Ferber steps for 24 hours straight? I said, yeah, sure, why not?
You did.
I did.
I was holding up a big stop sign and like, do you want to think about this? But no.
No, I didn't want to think about it. Clearly, I just
on.
Committed like, impulsively.
You did. You pushed on through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So that night, immediately afterwards, I was racked with, I think, a terror that I've never, a real sort of terror. Mm. And a true, just full body no's, like not body K-N-O-W-S, like body N-O's, like no. Mm. I had nightmares that night in bed. I dreamt all night about the Blue Mountains. I dreamt that Conrad Langridge and I were sliding down an ice sheet for ages.
Right. Very specific.
Yeah, very specific. We were careering out of control and we'd started something. We couldn't stop it.
Right.
I think probably was the thing there.
So did you dream that your quads like had disconnected themselves from your legs and
all of it.
Because that's what they were going to be doing.
That's what they were going to be doing. So the first thing I did in the morning is I messaged Gavin, got in contact with him and said, look, man, I know I said that, but I'm not doing it. There's no way in hell that I'm doing it. And the main reason, actually, I have to say, there's a couple of main reasons, but one, no. Two, I'd like to actually be able to run for the rest of the year. Three, Rebecca's coming overseas with us. It's the first time I've gone away, we've ever gone away without kids. You know, like, so there was lots of good, compelling reasons not to do it. So I'm stating on the record that, yeah, I got too excited and I absolutely will not be running up and down the Fibber Stairs for 24 hours.
There you go. There you go. Do you want me coming on your this trip? I don't know. Sounds like I'm going to be the third wheel.
You're not going to be the third wheel. If anything, Rebecca's going to be the third wheel. And I think we know this. That's the quiet part out loud, Eugene. That's the quiet part out loud. I didn't want to add insult injury by then running up and down the steps for 24 hours.
There you go. There you go. How did Gavin take it?
He was great, yeah. As usual. Yeah. He's a good sort. We'll still go over there and give it a good nudge. Mm. So
yeah. Mm. Yeah, so that's part of the plans that we have. And as you mentioned at the top, we're heading down to Otatahi Christchurch. Depending on when you listen to this, we may have already been there. But yeah, we've got the live show at Feather Faster, which we're very, very excited about. Anzac Day, I think tickets all gone or just about all gone. So yep. You might have been out of luck if you're thinking squeeze in late. But yeah, we're going to have a few yarns and we've got a couple of incredible guests. Jess Campbell, who's on her way to many big goals in the running world and running representing Aotearoa. And Michael Mitchell, adventure racer, can't read tonight, trail runner. He's done the Bob Graham round and he's gone through a shark attack. So plenty of stories, and it's going to be a fun old time down there. And then, as you said, you're going to be heading along to the skedaddle and racing on Saturday. I'll be there. I won't be racing, but I'll be there hanging out, cheering, doing things like that.
<It's> yeah, I'm excited.
Fun. Yeah.
It is. It is going to be fun. I'm doing the 43K, 2,000 meters of vertical gain in that. I was just actually, if you could see inside my laptop, you'd see that one of the tabs open is the elevation profile that I was studying before. So super excited.
Super excited. Hey, Leo.
Speaking of it.
Yeah, the old Fault Line Ultra on at the weekend. Whoa, some hills in there.
Absolutely. So we're not going to go over everything, but Aaron Vaughan taking away the inaugural 100 mile in 22:36.37 and Will Bell in a crushing time of 18:38.06, and looked like plenty of people had a good time.
Those are some solid times for the vert on that.
Yeah.
So in case you don't know, that was the run done in Wellington, and it took in plenty of incredible climbs, but also some trails that took you nice and close to the city itself. So looked like a great, and finished on the waterfront. Amazing. Mm. Yeah.
How good.
Yeah. Rootburn Classic. The classic. I think it's also known as the Sarah Douglas race, because she surely has naming rights by now, doesn't she?
Yeah, first person to win the event three times. Mm. She came crashing across 3:24.07. Toby Batchelor took out the win for the men with 2:48.02. And yeah, I think we're both in that boat that we would love to do that race.
Oh, yeah.
I'd just love to do the trail, actually.
Yeah. It's one way or another, it'd be good to get down there and do that. Look, there were a couple of other extraordinary feats going on over the weekend. Glenn Sutton, the legend, completed his Sounds to Town from Milford to Dunedin. It was 5 days and change. He was aiming for 617 kilometres. He was slightly short of that, but it just, you know, incredible run, incredible effort. And he raised about $15,000 for rural well-being program Farmstrong. He's just amazing, isn't he? Again.
Yeah. Well, and that looked hard.
Oh, yeah. Going through the Homer Tunnel alone.
Yeah. Oh! Yeah, through the Homer Tunnel. He did the root burn.
Yes.
Yep. Finished up at the Emerson's Brewery for a couple of beers.
Yeah.
No problem. Speaking of people who probably, they might need a couple of beers after this. Shannon Lee Litt, she marches or ultra marathons on with her quest to get into the Guinness World Book of Records. She's currently on consecutive ultra number 112, and that includes a couple of big races such as Tarawera and Northburn. Most have been around 51K, and she's currently running in Thailand, so she's dealing with the heat amazing. But we were there when she finished the 100 miler. Which she'd tapered with a 50K and then did a...
Did a 50K the next day. I know.
Doesn't
bear
thinking
about. And she's a lawyer, so she's still doing lawyer stuff. It's... Oh, amazing. Amazing. Anyway, she's trying to keep a bit on the lowdown until she gets, you know, actually knocks off the record. But she's just out there doing it day after day after day. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Right. Okay. This week... It's been a long time.
Been holding
coming,
our breaths for so long.
Actually, if we'd been holding our breaths, we'd be dead. This is an interview with Greg Hamilton. My goodness me. In case you haven't heard who Greg Hamilton is, he is the first Kiwi finisher of the Barclay Marathons. This was his third crack. He knocked off fun runs in 2019 and 2022. This year, there were five finishers, including the first female finisher, Jasmine Paris. I mean, you'd be living under a rock if you didn't know that. Barclay Marathon's five-loop course in the Frozen Head National Park in Tennessee, and Greg is from Christchurch. He is a two-time world champion in the Rogaine, and it's fair to say he is a quiet, humble man, but he was kind enough to agree to have a chat with us 5 years after we first asked him. Greatest run ever, which is the part of the show where we ask you to write in and tell us your greatest run ever. It doesn't have to be a race or a mount summit or that anything else for that matter. It might just be a run around the block, something that sunk to you for some reason. Send it in to us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. And this is from Brendan Montgomery. He writes, my greatest run ever so far. It's 4 a.m. and there's been some stars out. It's a good sign. We're up, coffee in, record time and on the road. We're from Punakaiki to Black Bull, headed for the start of the Paparoa. All week, the forecast has been fluctuating, but the general consensus is that it's a great lump of rain sitting over the Tasman Sea, just waiting to dump on the west coast. Will it come in before we're through the tops? Will it hold off till lunchtime? The lack of certainty prompts the early start. Lack of certainty is my Achilles heel when it comes to running. I've been thinking about this run for ages. In fact, I've definitely been overthinking it, as usual. I've wanted to run an ultra for about 10 years. Each time I've built a decent bit of fitness, I've had things crop up. He puts here, two hernia ops in the space of 8 months, long-term patella injury, plantar plane tear in my right foot, COVID twice, to name but a few. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's a lot of stuff. You may even remember my previous greatest run ever being more injury recovery story than run, even though the run itself was fab. Some real physical challenges and definitely a mental barrier to break through as well. So I made a conscious decision to try and get in and out, to get out of my head for this mission. I've been sorely tested in the build-up, visited by the ghosts of all my injuries past. Here, have a knee noodle. Oh, you're going to go to the gym and do the physio exercises for that? Well, what about tight hammies? Fine, you seem okay with that. Here's something else. No. It is that song that we were taught in primary school, you know, the thigh bones connected to the... That's real, eh?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a real thing.
Oh, yeah.
Each time I've had to have a talk with myself, and lo and behold, it's nothing serious. 6 a.m. and we're off. The dawn is stunning. We wind our way up Sez Clark Hut, popping out onto the tops, and it's beautiful. Cold and windy, though. Gloves on. None of us have more than 47 kilometers before, so we're taking it easy and mostly walking the hills. At 13 and a half kilometers in, the drizzle starts to set in. We can still see Barrytown Beach below us, but it's pretty grey and windy on the tops. That's not a good sign. It's not even 9 o'clock. This could be a long, wet day. Past Moonlight Hut, we wind up some forested bits. I'm just starting to feel a bit low. Glutes are tired, and I'm wondering if this is going to be a struggle. Stop it. You're overthinking this again. Suddenly, we round a corner onto some patchy sunshine. The vegetation's true colours shine through, vivid and delightful. The rain is gone, and the visibility increases. My friend Joe and I are in the lead, and rounding every corner reveals some new glorious vista. Fantastic slab rock formations, sheer drops to the west and east, rock escarpments that flow with the track, and a sweeping argillite basin that photos struggle to capture. Endorphins are flowing and the sore leg and doubt are forgotten. By the time we're off the tops, my cup is well and truly full. We pass below a spectacular waterfall and wonder what it would look like in the rain that still hasn't arrived. Pulling up to Porirati Hut, we chat with the trampers who are a bit envious about us going through in a day. More respect given when they find out we're running, not biking. Only 17 kilometers to go. Suddenly I know with a certainty I can do this. It's a wonderful realization. There's even a bit of welcome drizzle to cool me off. At 43.1 kilometers, which is the exact distance of my previous longest run, give or take a GPS error or two, there is a bridge to cross. A metaphorical Rubicon. Mm-hmm. We stop for a quick moment at 47 kilometres when we meet a runner who's come up the track from Punakaiki. He jumps on the train, but when the pace is slower and the conversation more monosyllabic than he envisaged, he shoots off. I guess we might look like ultra-running badasses, but none of us are feeling it right now. At 50k, there's a gate to go through, another threshold crossed. The swearing doesn't start until we hit the steps in the last couple of kilometres. Really, there are only two dozen or so. I spare a thought for the folks running in the Blue Mountains. Before I know it, there are the Po, marking the end of the track. We're done and super chuffed. What an epic day. Burgers and beer await. I'm so grateful. Grateful to my friends who joined me on the mission and much of the training. Grateful to the Paparoa, which was absolutely stunning. The rain doesn't hit in earnest until we were asleep.
Wow. That's so cool. And look, he talked about his not being able to capture this in photographs, and we've all been on trails like that, haven't we? But he did send us a couple of great photos, which we've put on the website too. So you can have a look at the website and have a read of what he had to say and also get inspired to go and run the Paparoa. I think that's an amazing, amazing trail. I really want to do it one day. The rest of you, send them in. Right, we should get on with this here interview.
Might as well start. Greg Hamilton, welcome to Dirt Church Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
That's we're certainly glad to have you on. Okay, we're going to punish you for the next hour. So your favorite thing, answering questions about yourself. So we're just going to dive right in, and I'd like to take it back if you would allow that. Look,
yep.
Can you give us a little bit about where you grew up and how you got into sports as a kid?
So I grew up in Christchurch, and I don't know if I was particularly sporty when I was younger. Probably in high school, I got into a bit of mountain biking and rock climbing, and then from there, a bit of tramping and mountaineering, and then a bit of orienteering, and then more running as I got you know, older, I guess. Yeah, it's a very brief outline.
We'll take it. We'll take it. And what does And sort of following on with that, you know, you get into sports at school and they're not your kind of traditional, you know, rugby, football,
yep,
water polo, hockey, mountain biking and rock climbing. What led you from that, you know, it's quite a wide start. What led you more to sort of the orienteering, running side of things?
Probably just a bit of luck, really, just at university. Some of the people that I ended up being friends with were into it, and so I gave it a go. It was fairly abysmal to start with, and sort of slowly improved a little bit. Just enjoyed it. I mean, I was with, you know, doing stuff with friends, so yeah, kept up at it.
Did you notice a point? Now, this might seem like an odd question. Were you conscious of, you said, you know, that you were, at your words, not mine, abysmal at it. Was there a point that you became not so abysmal at it, and what influenced that kind of change?
Yeah, no, I'm still abysmal at it.
You're in a church. You're in a church. It might be a dirt church, but it's still a church. Stop lying.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, you know, you can always find someone to compare yourself to, and you know, I've improved. Like, you know, instead of making a half hour mistake on something, you know, it's down to a few minutes or, you know, a few seconds. But you know, it's not. You still see a lot of mistakes. Like, or I see a lot of mistakes and a lot of places to improve. So, you know, I've improved, but you know, I wouldn't say I'm suddenly an expert. You know.
Okay, we'll circle back. We'll circle back to that. We'll circle back to that on the record. With Rogaining, do you see a wide variety of people engaging in the sport, or is it, or is doing what you do? I understand you're sort of quite analytical with computers and stuff. Is that an advantage in that sport?
So I think, like, in Rogaining in general, there's like a wide variety of people, like in a wide variety of abilities, and probably desires as well on how well they want to do. So that's really enjoyable with the Rogaining. I think it probably does appeal to a certain type of person. I think orienteering and Rogaining are very similar in that respect. You know, someone who's a bit more, I guess, as you said, analytical. is probably going to be keener on it, and maybe partly because they are analytical, they sort of improve, and that's what keeps them there. Yeah, it's definitely a fair number of engineers or people with sort of advanced degrees.
Not too many feelings nurses like myself. Like for a complete, like, utter numpty.
Yep.
Pointing at myself. Can you explain the difference between traditional orienteering and what a Rogaine is?
Yep. So, an orienteering course is you've got get given a map and it's got controls on it, and they're ordered from, you know, number you're going to start, and then 1 to say 30 or something like that. And you've got to get them in a set order, and the person who wins is the person who gets them all in the correct order in the fastest time. So it's just a straight race from that point of view. A Rogaine has a set time limit. You get given a map with a whole lot of controls on it. Each of those controls is worth a differing number of points. You can get them in any order that you want, and as many as you want. And so the aim for a Rogaine is, in that set period of time, to score as many points as you want. So there's, before you start the event, there's a planning period, and that could be several hours long. And it's quite, you know, if you don't plan well, it could be very hard to win an event, because you're just either not getting enough points or you're way over ambitious and then you are late back. So there's quite a bit of skill and strategy in planning a good course.
Right, so I'm guessing there's a mix of you want to, like you said, have the different points. So I would surmise that the ones that are more difficult to get to, perhaps further away on more gnarly terrain, are worth more points than the ones that's like at the bus stop.
Sometimes, but not always. It's right. Dependent on the person who's planned it. So sometimes it's like that. Other times, it's almost the opposite. There's some, you know, close or, you know, medium distance away that are high points, and those ones that are, you're very, very far away, are not worth money at all. But if you're one of the top teams, you're then sort of forced to make a decision to, you know, halfway through a course, go and get a very low point control and then potentially miss out on some high points later on when you're coming back to the finish. I wouldn't surmise that.
I didn't understand that part of it, that it was a gamble, you know, or not a gamble as such, but there's an element of that sort of, it can be the difficulty, the degree of fiendishness can be is set by the person laying out the controls.
Yep. And you in the Rogaine, you are sort of constantly making that decision as you're out there, you know, are you ahead of where you think you should be at that point in time? Can you pick up another one, or do you need to drop a control because you're now behind time? And if you do need to drop something, is it one soon or is it later on? And it's sort of, there's a sort of a cascade effect there. If you sort of cut something early on, maybe you're going to regret that later, or, you know, it puts you in a bad position for your course. So there's, yeah, it's quite a bit of strategy there. The other difference between the Rogaine and the orienteering is the orienteering courses are generally under 2 hours in length, and the Rogaines are usually from often 3 hours to 24 hours.
Wow. 24 hours of Rogaining. That sounds
fun.
That's hectic.
My brain hurts thinking about that.
Yeah, we once had an opportunity. We were at the end of a 62-kilometer ultra marathon trying to figure out Jared Hazen's average pace at Western States.
Yep.
Neither of us could do that, so we'd be useless on a 24-hour Rogaine. Hey, look, I just want to. One of the things that I think is really beautiful around your kind of, what appears to be your sort of ethos around the sport or the engagement. You wrote to us in 2022 in one of your really lovely emails to us, and you wrote this and you said, one thing that doesn't get much coverage in social media and podcast is that it appears to be all about the racer. However, there's often a poor overlooked partner at home after the kids, the house and the working. It can sometimes feel unfair that the person off having fun gets all the attention and the person at home is the one who has the hardest job. So, here's your chance. Who's that person for you? And tell us about the support that you got to make this happen.
Yeah, it's my partner, Claire. It's immense, the support you get at home that's not seen. So, I mean, the biggest bit for me is just being away for 2 weeks. It's just it's a massive load on her. And, you know, we get a bit of help from our grandparents, which is great. but it's still, you know, there's very little downtime for her for 2 weeks. Her chances of going out and doing some exercise are greatly reduced for those 2 weeks. And then in the months leading up to it, you know, you try your best to try and manage the situation and mitigate it. But with the, you know, increased training, you know, you come home and you're a bit more tired. And so she's sort of constantly picking up the slack there for, you know, a very long, prolonged period of time there. So it's amazing what she does there. Can't really thank her enough for that.
Oh, shout out to Claire.
Yeah, and all the other Claires, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? We all have people who support us in all sorts of different ways, and that's our partners, our, you know, our friends who, you know, or work colleagues and so on, isn't it? It's a cliche, but it kind of takes a village, doesn't it?
Yep, it does.
Hey, look, I want to ask about Barclay. Is this apparently this race that you did, I think? When was the first time you heard about it, and what made you think you'd like to do it someday?
So I read about it, I think, in the early 2000s. And I think I was just sort of looking at some web pages about running. And this one, I think there was one that popped up that had a whole lot of links, different things. And one of them was the Barclay Marathons. And then I think it was a website, Matt Mahoney's got a website with a lot of information about the Barclay, or a lot of the history. And on that, there was some race reports, and I read through a few of them, and it just sounded like a great event. Like, just, you know, some of the stories there are fantastic about, in general, about the failures of people, but, you know, the odd success as well. So it just sort of appealed from that. You know, just.
Mm. But it kind of sat with you for some time before you entered, or I guess got accepted. That was part of a process as well. What was it that made you think you were ready to give it a crack?
I just got to the point where I thought, I probably have the skills and possibly the ability to do reasonably well at it.
I was going to say, was it something that you'd actually worked towards, or was it just sort of, it was in the back of your mind, and then eventually you thought, I've got this and this, I can give it a crack?
I think it was sort of just in the back of your mind, like, you know, you see lots of cool things, you're like, oh, that'd be cool to do one day, that'd be nice. And then, you know, you sort of get to a point and you go, oh, I guess I could actually do that now. So it wasn't like, oh, I think that's cool and I'm just going to work, you know, single-mindedly towards it. It was like, I'm, you know, busy doing lots of other things, and eventually you get to a point where you go, oh, I think I'm probably maybe close to fit enough, or, you know, I think I've got the other skills.
What were those things that you sort of needed to tick off in your head or otherwise to think, yeah, I can do it, I can have a crack?
I guess, you know, you need to be able to navigate semi-okay. You need to be able to move at a reasonable speed. You know, it's a scorching 3K an hour. I think I can probably manage that. your ability to look after yourself. It's just sort of, and you go, oh, yeah, I think I, you know, I sort of broke it down and you go, well, this is what's sort of required, and it's like, oh, I think I can do the majority of that.
And then having decided, and maybe you're not allowed to tell us this, but because there are so many secrets around the race, but how hard was it to get in that first time, and how long was that process?
I was very lucky. I got in the first time I entered, and you know, I'd had the information for a wee while before that on how to enter. It was... For me, it wasn't too bad to get in, but you know, right, there's always that uncertainty. Yeah. You sort of apply, and then you're not sure if you're going to get in or not.
Apparently, neither of us would know. But Matt Bixley, who, you know, who had gone and done it himself, and I understand, you know, you're in the same orienteering club, and of course, you know, he'd been there. Did you talk with him, and what did he say that helped you, or not?
I did discuss with him before, or just in general, but it was before I went. It was good. You know, he sort of, his information sort of just confirmed my thinking of what it was like. So that was good. It was nice to have some first hand knowledge like that.
Yeah, Yeah. We also understand that, you know, of course, we all know him as the mouth from the south, and we heard, in fact, that it could have been a Bixley sledge that that got you there. Maybe you're too slow for Barclay, something like that, that might have got you going. Any truth in that?
No.
All right, we'll let him off. But you're a member of the Worsley Warriors training group in Christchurch, you know, a group that dates back to the days of Coast to Coast hero Keith Murray in the early 90s. And, you know, just like Keith, you're a bit of a dark horse and, you know, obviously incredibly talented. How important has it been for you to train with a group like that, and what does it give you?
I mean, for me, it's just a great group of people to spend some time with. I really enjoy my runs with them. Very easy to get on with, and it's just, you know, it's a extra little bit of encouragement. You know, you sort of wake up and you go, I better get up and go for the run. You know, it's seeing some other people, it's much easier to get out for your runs regularly than getting up and going out by yourself day after day. So for me, you know, that's one of the big benefits of it. I've got to admit, though, I normally start early, so not quite good enough to keep up with them.
When I spoke to Marty Lukes, he said, and I do it to this day, that the piece of advice he gave me, because, you know, the famous Worsley Warrior, always point your running shoes towards the door. In the morning. So I do that every time I get up. I point my running shoes. They never heel to the door. They're always facing out the door, and it's some small psychological victory every time.
Yeah.
Hey, look, I just wanted to ask you, before going in to Barclay in 2019, what were your expectations?
For myself?
Yeah.
I guess I hope to finish the course. I didn't have any... you really don't know how we're going to do or what it's like. That was the expectation or the hope. I didn't want to hope for less. It's a long way to go to just hope to get, you know, to the start line or to get around one loop. So
you came away with a fun run.
Yep.
And can you describe it, actually, because fun run it's an incongruous term. So what's the definition of a Barclay Marathon's fun run?
You've got to do 3 loops in under 40 hours. I think it's 13 hours 20 per loop is what you've got to average. It's a fun run.
Sounds excellent. And completing 4 loops in under 40 hours, which means that, you know,
four under 40 is a lot harder.
Not even good at that math. 3 under 40, so you get out. You could get out for your fourth loop.
Yep.
It's a big ask. People around the world are going like, "Who is this guy? Who's this Kiwi guy?" Were you happy? Your expectation was to finish. Were you happy getting that fun run? And what was it like for you getting attention?
Luckily, I didn't get too much attention, so it was quite good. I could just ignore the odd email that came. I guess...
It's very odd.
I thought I'd learnt quite a bit there. So, I mean, that was some positives there. But, I thought I could do better.
And what were those things that, not to kind of, bust down that fourth wall, but in 2019, what were those things that you thought that, okay, if I'm going to do better, what have I got to do?
So it was just a few small things, really. You know, I felt I did quite well on a number of areas, but I thought I could probably get a little bit fitter. I thought my nutrition wasn't quite as good as it could have been. Some of it was a little bit of luck as well. Like it was, it went from mid to high 20s, I think, on the first loop. And then on the second loop, it was raining and down to freezing level. And then we got some sleety snow. So quite a big temperature variation. And I quite, I don't mind the rain and the snow. That was fine. There was some fog as well, which made it a little bit more challenging for the navigation. But once it rains there, it's... The climbs are very slippery, so it just slows you down a little bit there as well. So I felt, with different weather, could go a little bit better as well. And then there was just a few navigation mistakes I made, which were unfortunately significant. But yeah.
So then, 2019, that's amazing. 2022,
yep.
You had another fun run, but you've been away for a couple of years thanks to the pandemic. Was it hard, or must have been hard, having that break in terms of remembering bits of the course and strategies? Did you have a different mindset going in 2022?
It was probably reasonably similar to the first time, I think. And I, you know, I don't remember that much of the course. So the first time, I treated it more as a Rogaine, so I had a map and compass out quite a lot. Others seemed to be able to memorize most of the course and barely get their map out at all. So coming back the second time, I didn't find it too much of a struggle. And the course had changed a bit as well between the first and second time, so there were some new bits for everyone. Yeah, I think, you know, I felt I did a little bit better on some places, and other places I could still improve. So I think that time I struggled a lot with the sleep deprivation, sort of from near the end of the third loop.
We got super excited that you'd completed another fun run, and we wrote you an email in 2022, and we've got all the receipts, Greg. So you wrote us, and you're so nice. You've been so nice. In 2022, you said to us, "I'm not sure I'd have much to say, as all I did was go round and round circles slower and slower. By the time I got back, most of the runners had left and camp was almost empty. A couple of hours after I finished, there was practically no one left, so it was very peaceful. That combined with the fact that I spent the last 35 hours of the race by myself makes for quite an unexciting discussion." How hard is it to run that much on your own? I had imagined that there'd have been a lot of sort of teamwork with the other runners at Barclay, and that you'd interact quite a bit. Tell us about that aspect.
So for me, I don't mind being by myself for quite a while like that. And yeah, and out in the forest is fine. So I think for some people, that they find that quite intimidating, being particularly at night time or if the bad weather in night time, and you're navigating and you're off tracks. But I don't have really any concerns about that. I sort of, you know, I feel confident with where I am, and I'm confident looking after myself. So for me, it's just a nice, enjoyable time out there. Yeah, I think that's the...
So it's 35 hours of peace.
Yeah.
So we could have had a good old chat.
But yeah, there's not much excitement there. For the teamwork, I think that just sort of... It's a little bit of luck. Like, so both of those first two times, I was near Carol Sabe. And we just had slightly different speeds, so he was faster up the hills than I was, and then I'd catch a little bit up on the downhills. So, like, if you looked at the time splits, often it looked like we were together for most of it, but in actual fact, I think we spent very, very little time together. We were always just, yeah, not travelling at the same speed at the same places.
Right. Yeah. So, you, obviously, this year, at what point did you think, okay, I'm going to go back?
I mean, I was always keen to go back straight away. But you can never be certain that you're actually going to get a chance to go back or be fit enough to go back, or, you know, life's going to conspire. So, I mean, I was never certain that it was going to happen, until you sort of get a chance to put the entry in. And, you know, that sort of happens when you're just by luck, you know, you've got fit enough by then and, you know, life's going well.
Mm. So you know you're living in Christchurch, and which is certainly not the Frozen Head National Park. But how did you train for it?
Going running. I mean,
have you got your camera off because Laz is there with a gun to your head?
No, I mean it was just sort of regular runs up on the Port Hills here on the edge of Christchurch, a few longer day trips. There wasn't anything special. I've never spent much time in the park. I know others have gone over weeks before. It's never been something I've sort of wanted to do. I think doing five loops is enough time in the park Don't need to go over the same train more than that. Yeah, just out having fun in the hills here with friends.
Yeah.
Is a train.
So mostly in the hills themselves, rather than you weren't heading off to, you know, near the national parks or anything around down south?
No, so I think I got, in the 4 or 5 months leading up to it, I think I got a 24-hour gain, and then I think I got 3 day trips into the mountains. And that seems, I don't know, that's enough. Like, you can get away and do a couple of long things to get used to your nutrition and make sure everything sort of works without being a massive drain on the home life. And I think if you have too many of those long days as well, it gets tiring. Like, it impacts the rest of your training. Like, you know, if you do a big long day, you know, then next week you can't really train as hard as if you had a shorter day. And I don't think those long days actually give you that much benefit. Like, psychologically they might help, or, you know, just to check your nutrition or the, you know, your pack and stuff like that. But day after day of it, I don't think it really helps.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that balance, isn't it? Getting that balance right.
Yeah.
What, I mean, you've mentioned nutrition a couple of times. That's always changing, isn't it? and as you get older and as you get faster and slower, and it's always different. So what works for you?
What works for me is lots of gels. I seem to go quite well on gels. I have some lollies and chips, and I've been having some dehydrated smoothies, which have been very good. A few muesli bars, a few biscuits, fairly boring. I think the biggest change I've had is I've just focused a bit more on eating and training. On the longer runs, just so that I can get used to consuming more food. And I think that's been beneficial. Like, I can go okay with not much food, but I think with more food, I've gone better.
Right, yeah. When you're not, apart from those long days in the mountains, how long would a long run be in your build up to Barclay?
Most of my runs are probably in the 1 to 2 hour range. Probably every couple of weeks, I'd get a 3 to 4 hour run in on the hills here.
So not huge at all.
No, I think like those big long ones, I think they just make you slow. You're just out there for a long time going slow, whereas you need a bit of speed as well. So I think
We had another source, and again, this may be the same as the one that we came to earlier, so I might want to shoot this one down as well. But they said that they knew something was up because you were more regular at Worsley Warriors sessions than an athlete sponsored by Allbran, and that you were spotted doing gnarly reps on one of the Port Hills steepest streets. Is that true? Care to comment?
No, I don't know that's true either. I try to be reasonably regular all the time.
Matt, we're going to get better sources. Oh my goodness!
Well, this source did actually say the exact quote was, "I wonder what he got up to in his spare time."
So you know, and again, on that training, are you incorporating hill reps and things like that, or are you just out there having fun?
Mostly out there having fun. I did do a few little hill reps that. But what I find is they're not particularly exciting.
Right.
So mentally it's quite hard to do it regularly. And I don't know that it gives that much more benefit than just going out for runs and enjoying it. I did do a few. And I did do 2 or 3 that I tried to do at a higher intensity, which may or may not have been beneficial. But
The thing about Barclay that people often overlook is that you do have to be moving. You know, you can't sit around and dawdle. So you do have to be fast enough. Did you do any speed work? You integrate any speed work into your training? Are you sort of mindful of that?
I was mindful of that. You know, there is a sort of certain speed that you need to go at. I sort of did a mixture. You know, I did quite a lot on the hills. I did a little bit of flat stuff as well. I didn't do a heap of speed work though. I think you do need to be able to move at a reasonable pace, but not 3 minute Ks or anything like that. and it's funny as well because it's not really that that top end speed that's the important bit. It's the what you can go at after 12 hours or 24 hours or 36 hours. You know, can you keep moving at a reasonable speed then? I think which is more of the key. But I mean, it is impacted a little bit. You know, if you've got a higher top end speed, then percentage wise, that will feel a little bit easier. But I think you've got to have that basic, that lower end speed as well.
The atmosphere of Barclay, I mean, so few of us will ever get to experience running there or even going to Frozen Head State Park in Tennessee. Thanks to the, you know, thanks to social media, most of us have an idea of what it looks like. But what's the atmosphere like when you get there?
When I've got there, I've always got there a few days early, and it's been very, very peaceful and relaxed. You know, there hasn't been that many runners there when I've got there. There's been, you know, maybe half a dozen, 10 other people there, and most of them are not runners. I find it quite a peaceful place. It's quite, at that time of year, it's quite stark. You know, there's not that many leaves on the trees. It's reasonably cold. Like, I think when I was there this time, it was often a little bit below zero at night time. And I think I was in a down jacket most of the time before the start of the race, like most of the days before the start of the race. It's I don't know. American campsites are a little bit different from here. You know, you've got your paved road through there, and you've got your set bit of gravel that's, you know, your site that you've got. There's no nice grassy spots to camp on. It's it's sort of in the middle of the forest as well. You know, there's no great views from that campsite. You're just sort of in trees, and it's slightly cold, and it's.
On camping on gravel.
Yeah.
Sounds.
Have I put you off going?
Oh, look, you'd put me off at hello, but the gravel's, I must say, it's the last straw for me. Cancelling my plane ticket now.
No, Les, I refuse to. Look, yeah. Look, as much as you plead with me, that's it. I'm not right. Coming.
That's right. There'd only be one bib I'd be getting at Barclay, and it'd be bib number one, I tell you what. Look, but tell us about the race itself in 2024. Was it different? What were the key moments for you?
I don't know if there were any key moments. I mean, it was a little bit different in that, you know, the course had changed quite a bit again. So every time I've been, it's changed quite a bit. This time, I think the first 8 out of the 9 books for me had changed locations. Some had only changed slightly. Some had changed significantly. So that was quite a big difference. And then out on the first loop, the biggest difference was just the number of people. So normally for the first hour or two, it's a little bit chaotic. There's a reasonably high pace, and sort of it seems to be, you know, quite a few people pushing quite hard. And then after, you know, a couple of hours, it spreads out, and you sort of there's been a group that sort of pulled away in the front, and then I've sort of ended up in a bit of a bunch slightly further back. And this time it was a very large bunch at the front there for quite a long time. And then I think behind that, it sort of quickly dropped off. You know, there weren't that many people behind that bunch. And then it was quite a way back to the rest of the people. So that was a bit different, and having so many people. And we were moving, I felt we were moving at a reasonable speed as well. It was quite interesting to see just how big a punch that was.
Just trying to it's like trying to describe a elephant to a blind man, really, isn't it? Unless you're actually there and experiencing it, it's very hard to put that together. We talked about support at the top, but who did you have crewing for you, and how important was that? Because in 2019, you were self-supported?
Yep. Yeah. The first year I turned up and I didn't have anyone. It's quite nice not having anyone. You sort of just turn up, and I just treated it a bit like an adventure race or something like that. You know, you've got a transition you come back to a few times. There's not that much that you need to, like, you know, the bare minimum. You know, you need to get a little bit more food and drink. Maybe change your socks, something like that. So that was what I focused on the first time. And you need to look after yourself on the first loop and potentially at the end of the second loop. But by the by the end of the third loop, there's been a fair few people who've pulled out, so you sort of get a bit of help from them. So I got some help there. And on those first two loops, I got a little bit of help from a guy called Mike Dobies. So that was beneficial. And then on the second and the third attempts, I've ended up with an amazing person, Sarah Smith. And this is just a friend of a friend. She got recommended to me, and it's been amazing having her, but just pure luck that I've ended up with her. And so it's made it, you know, instead of being self-supported, you know, you've got someone there just looking after everything, which for me, I sort of struggle with a little bit because, you know, it's like, you know, I've left home. I don't need mum to wipe my bottom anymore. You know, I can sort of... So, you know, to have someone...
You're like the anathema of the Barclay, aren't you? You turn up by yourself, everyone's like, who's this guy? Do you want to follow me on Instagram? Not particularly, mate. Can I follow you on Instagram? Well, you can't. I'm not on Instagram. Where's your crew? Don't have any.
Yep, that's me. but oh, so it's been amazing having you here. Been very lucky. Yep.
There's a moment. Social media, wonderful thing. This is how we know about all these moments. Harvey Lewis wrote about that you were able to sort of calmly find a book that no one else could after sitting down and having something to eat. Do you remember that moment? And can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it was. Oh, it was quite early on in the first loop, like maybe 3 hours or something like that. And there was still quite a large group there. And I think it was just after a water stop. So some people had stopped for water, and Harvey and I had continued on, and we got up to the location of the book, sort of in the first few people, and we sort of had a look around, and we hadn't seen it in the places we'd looked, and then there were more and more people arriving after getting their water. And it sort of got to the point where there's, you know, 15 people there, and everyone's madly searching, and I just decided, well, if there's that many people searching, I might as well just have some food and water. And, you know, someone's going to find it, and I'll be at the back of the queue to get my page, but, you know, I will have had some food and water. So that's what I did. And then I sort of, as I was looking around, I was like, oh, you know, that place that we'd sort of searched near the start, it's like, well, it does look quite promising. And there'd been a few more people sort of looking at it, but, yeah, just happened to go over there and have a really good look at it. And, yeah, happened to be there, so...
And that was, you had a proper look, because that was that the one where you had to sort of poke your head right into a tree?
Yeah, so there's a tree with quite a big sort of split down the side of it, and it was sort of hollow in the middle. And everyone sort of, you can sort of stick your head half in, and you can sort of put your hand around, and it you know, hadn't been found. So you had to, yeah, I stuck my head right in and sort of pushed up right against the inside, sort of closest to where you were standing, but you know, hardest place to see or touch. It was just sort of sitting in there.
So. And did you? I bet you made a big song and dance about it when you did find it.
No.
The rest of you, you've had a kid's look.
Yeah. Quietly just, put the book back. Yeah. Take off.
Yep, just disappeared quietly. Yep.
So you set out anti-clockwise on lap five.
Yes.
I think I've got that right.
Yep.
I had a 50% chance. What was your mindset going out? And were you, like, that was the first time you'd been out on loop five, right? And so was that sort of, you know, were you convinced you could do it, or were you still a bit unsure? What was your mindset?
I was feeling pretty good when I went out on loop five. I was feeling quite fresh still. And I had a reasonable amount of time, like maybe close to 13 and a half hours. So I thought that was a reasonable shot to do it, or reasonable chance to get around. But you definitely don't know until you've finished it, really. And I thought, you know, I could move reasonably well at the start there, but I made a few mistakes, and they sort of weigh heavily on you. You sort of go, well, you know, I've just wasted, you know, X number of minutes. You know, is that the mistake that sort of breaks it, you know, that sort of finally stops you from finishing. So each time I made a little mistake like that, it was a little bit more stress that, you know, you've thrown away your chance. So, you know, it definitely wasn't, I didn't feel like I'd finished it, or, you know, I was going to finish it.
That being able to deal with a mistake or an issue or worrying about the time, and it must just get exponentially harder the further in you are, because the stakes are kind of higher.
Yeah, Yeah, no, definitely on that last loop, I was surprised at the sort of the stress you feel once you've made a mistake. You know?
Right.
But, you know, but I think, you know, in saying that, you know, once you've made it, you just, I mean, that's been made, so you just got to deal with it, how to fix it up and keep going.
You've got to move on.
Yeah, so you can't really dwell on it.
Yeah. Les's notes after the race, he said, Greg Hamilton back for one more go at the elusive prize, most elusive prize in running. Maybe his last chance, as his great athletic career is closer to twilight than noon. Bit mean. Add in that his previous attempts all combined had not seen the good weather of a single day this year. He was not letting the opportunity get away. Even a major navigational error on the fifth loop did not rattle him. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, I don't know that it was a major navigational mistake there. I made, well, if it was, I made numerous major navigational mistakes. but I did make, you know, a good number of them on that last loop, and I think it was just, you know, tiredness catching up. So I mean, when I made that mistake, I was in front of John Kelly, and I think I sort of veered off the spur a little bit, and he'd gone past and hadn't seen me, and by the time I got back on, he was sort of gone.
And so you sort of separated.
Well, it was funny because we went out pretty much together and we were separated by quite a bit at the start, and then I'd made a mistake and he got in front of me, and then I got within a few minutes of him, and then he sort of, so I'd catch sight of him, and then he'd just sort of disappear into the forest, be less visibility at some point, and, you know, an hour later I'd catch him again in the distance, and then another hour later I'd catch him again in the distance. So we spent very little time together. I think we spent probably 10, maybe 15 minutes together on the whole loop.
Wow.
And yeah, even though we were probably within 5 or 10 minutes of each other for almost the whole loop.
So you really are running your own race.
Yep. And you sort of, I don't know, I was trying to ignore other people as well. You sort of just got to look after yourself and do what makes sense for you.
Yeah, yeah. Finally, running towards that yellow gate. What was that like? Tell us about that.
That was kind of good. I'd had a little moment early on in the loop five, around 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd been going well, and I was, you know, we'd almost been to the 12 hours left mark, and then a little while later, I sort of looked down at my watch, and it was, you know, 0001 and some seconds. And I'd had a sort of horrible panic that I'd managed to reset my watch. And so I was like, well, I think I was close to the 48-hour mark. You know, has it just rolled over, or have I managed to reset it? So coming into the finish there, I was a little bit unsure as to whether I had actually reset my watch and I was under the cutoff, or whether I was, you know, just a few minutes over it.
Wow.
So it was quite nice to actually get in and confirm that I was under the cutoff.
Did you literally not know until you...
I wasn't 100% certain, no.
Wow. Who told you?
Well, that I was under... Well, when I got there, it was sort of, you know, it became obvious that I was under the cutoff. But yeah, it was...
People were hooping and hollering because you'd missed out.
Yeah.
There's the dude with his bugle. Look, this year was so special for us, obviously, down here with you being the first Kiwi finisher, but also, you know, the year that Jasmine Paris made such an incredible breakthrough for women. Do you want to talk a bit about that and what it was like, what it meant to be there to sort of witness that very historical moment?
I mean, it was just great to see someone finish like that. I'd spent a little bit of time on Luke Fortha. We hadn't chatted much. You're sort of in your own little bubble, but we were together for a while there. And I was impressed just how well she was moving and navigating. Yeah, she was going very, very well. And she'd actually been in front of me the whole time until then. And then I saw her briefly on loop five when we sort of passed in opposite directions. And at that point, it looked a little bit touch and go. I wasn't sure how much time I had left, but I felt we're sort of roughly halfway around, so I felt that she was going to be quite close to the cutoff. So when I finished and she wasn't in, I was a little bit unsure as to, you know, how close to the cutoff she really was, whether she was going to make it or not. And then it sort of, the time ticks down and it got down to, I think just under 5 minutes, and I was thinking, I haven't seen or heard anything yet. And so I felt a little bit sad because, you know, someone's put in so much effort for 2.5 days and potentially just going to miss the cutoff. So to see her come in or come up the road, you know, with enough time to finish, that was pretty good. You know, and then just, it was quite cool, the atmosphere there. You know, everyone was just really cheering her on up the road there. And yeah, to see her push so hard was pretty special as well. And so the thing, you know, you see some footage and you see her running up the road for like, you know, a minute. And you see her sort of exhausted at the end there. But, you know, she's known for quite a bit longer than that how close to the cutoff she is. So she's been pushing potentially, you know, for an hour or more, just knowing that, you know, you're right close to the cutoff. So I think that's quite impressive, just to, yeah, how she's managed to handle that.
Yeah, she's a very impressive competitor, all right.
Yep.
These sources that we've enlisted, because we've done our homework, they said this of you. Greg's a competitor, speaking of fierce competitors. Greg's a competitor, although he will deny this till he's blue in the face. He likes to win. This is a real benefit for things like the Barclay, where the win is to finish. And he also likes to suffer. Greg is addicted to type 2.9 fun. Now, as the source said, you'd probably deny it, but are you a competitive person?
Yep, I'm a competitive person. There you go.
Oh, we got one.
You got one. Yes. I deny the suffering bit, though. I don't think I suffer. Like,
do you perceive it as suffering, or is it like you said in the Gary Robbins interview, you were talking about how it was, you used the word enjoyable. When you're out there, you know, you're 50 hours deep, you know, it's all gone, and it can feel, I'm sure, like it's going south as much as it was. Is that enjoyable for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun time. Like, for me, I had 2.5 days of fun out in the forest. I didn't feel like I was suffering at all there. Okay, you know, I think if you're out there suffering, it's probably not a very, you know, it'd be hard to keep coming back to something, you know. So for me, it's just a fun time, you know. Sure, there's bits that feel hard, and you know, other bits where you feel really good, but it's at no point am I suffering.
On that, do you think that now that you've, you know, to use the words of another laconic New Zealander, knocked the bastard off, do you think that you'll be back, or is that you're donezo?
So I really enjoy the race. I really enjoy the atmosphere there. I don't know that I'll be back. I mean, you know, if you didn't have a family and you had, you know, unlimited free time, then it'd be much easier to make a decision to go, yep, I'd go back. But I think, you know, it's such a big strain on the family that it'd be hard to justify going back. But, you know, when I think about it, you go, like, you know, I could do that different, I could do this different, you know. And it does appeal to me, you know, it's not like it's a tick box and I've ticked it and I'm never going back. So, you know, there's definitely bits that are enjoyable, but I think, you know, I don't know that I'll be back to it. And additionally, you know, there's only 40 people to get in each year. So for me to go back, that means someone else doesn't get a chance. So, you know, you don't want to go back and just have a half-hearted go at it either. So, yeah, there you go. I've hedged my bets.
Fair enough. Yeah. How special is it to say that you've finished the Barclay Marathons?
I don't know. I don't know that it's that special at all.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, for me personally, you know, it's satisfying personally that I've done it, but, you know, it's not something that I go, you know, hi, I'm Greg Hamilton, I finished the Barclay Marathons.
You should get a t-shirt, because then you're uncomfortable saying it, but if you've got it on your shirt,
it's,
you just,
it's all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it was a personal thing. It wasn't, you know, anything else.
Can you understand that it might be very special for other people, as you know, that this is something that
For them to finish personally?
Well, if I finished, but know that you finished, that you're one of a very small group of people that have finished this race that existed in beautiful obscurity for, you know, a decade and a half, 2 decades. And then there was the Netflix documentary, and suddenly, kaboom, it's this, you know, it's the Mount Olympus of difficulty, and you're one of a few people that have finished it.
Yeah, I guess so. I appreciate that.
We were at a backyard event. I think this was in one of our emails to you. Can we get the restraining order put off? Anyway, but I think I said this in an email to you that we were at it at a backyard at Riverhead,
yep,
which Laz had come out to last year on that day when you finished, and it was a big deal. You know, like, we have a niche sport. Let's face it.
Yep.
And it's a niche within a niche is backyards, and then Barclay is a niche. You know, within that. So granted, but it was a huge deal. You know, it meant a lot to people.
Yeah,
that must feel nice.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
I have a supplementary question submitted for the record. Okay, Laz is known for two things, right?
Yep.
He's known for Barclay. He's also known for Big's Backyard.
Yep.
Your mate Stu just did pretty well at the Riverhead Relapse, you know, adventure racer going out there,
yep,
and getting the win. Does that format interest you?
So I've looked at it, and I don't know. Like, I can sort of see a little bit of an appeal, like, just to see how well you could do. But in a lot of ways, it doesn't appeal. Like, the thought of just running slightly slower than natural for days on end, potentially, is less of an appeal for it. But I mean, you know, there's obviously certain psychological aspects of the race. So, you know, I haven't been super excited to do one, I couldn't rule it out either. But yeah, it doesn't have the same appeal as the Barclay does. And I think, you know, that, you know, challenging myself physically is quite appealing, whereas the backyard doesn't quite have that same aspect. Well, in my perspective, you know, as a person who hasn't run it, so.
it's an interesting format for real, and it has some, like any one, it had some pluses and minuses. It's certainly it's something that all the cool kids are doing at the moment, and but yeah, it's
hence I haven't done one,
and I've done one badly. So you know,
I can sort of see there's a certain appeal of like mastering something like that as well. You know,
yeah.
So, yeah, definitely.
The psychology, obviously, is the big thing, isn't it? You don't have, you know, obviously the navigation's not an issue. But the psychology of it, the challenge of being able to keep going when, you know, your body must just be going, come on, this is pointless.
Be
interesting. Anyway, yeah. So if the roles were reversed and somehow say I or Matt had managed to finish Barclay and you were interviewing us, because I know you'd probably love to be doing a podcast, hosting a podcast, what would you have asked us?
What have I asked you? Probably, you know, I'd be interested in your training for it, and also probably the mental aspect of it. Like, I think that's often missed. People focus a lot on the physical training, and not so much on the mental side of racing. And I've seen that quite a lot in races. The way people speak before a race, you can often tell how well they're going to do or how well they're not going to do. So it'd be interesting to see that side of it, you know, how you approached it mentally.
It's a very good question, Greg. So how did you approach the Barclay marathons mentally?
You're a little bit transparent with the question, I must say.
Yet you walked right in.
We thought we were covering the tracks.
I felt obliged.
So serious question. Do you go from book to book, or do you break stuff up into moment to moment, tree to tree? Are you a whole thing or a chunk by chunk?
I think it changes. You know, I think you've got to have the approach that you've gone to finish. So, you know, it's not a chunk by chunk. It's not like I'll do one lap and then I'll see how I do, you know, whether I'm good enough to do the second loop or feel good enough. So it's definitely, you know, you've got to have that overall approach. And then out there, it's a combination of things. You know, it's probably loop by loop, really. But, you know, sometimes it is, you know, the current focus is just to get to the next book, and then you get to the next book. And so as, in a way, it's similar to the Rogaine's, you know, it's broken down to control by control. But you sort of, in the back of your mind, you've got the bigger picture there.
Yeah. So having that sort of dual strategy going.
Yeah.
Is that, do you work on your mental skills specifically, or is it just that's who you are?
I don't know. Maybe it's a combination of both. Like, you know, maybe they're reasonable to start with, and but it is something that I'm definitely aware of. And you know, if you, because I've seen it, you know, if you go from thinking you can do something to going, well, I can't do it, it just changes you. It's like a flick of a switch, you know. You've gone from, oh yeah, I can do it, to like, there's just no hope at all, and you slow down and everything changes. So it's definitely something that I'm aware of in that respect. And then just the way you talk about things as well, even just to yourself, I think is quite important. Like, you know, you hear some people and you know, they've decided someone else is better than them, or they're going to do better than them. And once you've sort of decided someone else is going to do better than you, it's sort of, I think it sort of handicaps you. You're going, well, you know, they're going faster than me, and you're beaten down a little bit to start with. So I think, yeah, probably it's a combination.
I'm not sure if this is in the same territory, but when you were talking about John Kelly, you know, he's someone who's proven he could do it. You know, he's a multiple finisher.
Yep.
And I guess one strategy might have been, I'm just going to hang on to him no matter what. But you were comfortable enough in your own skin to go, oh, I'm here for my race.
Yep. I mean, I think, you know, on that loop five, I felt better at that point in time. So it seemed to make sense to try and make hay while the sun shines and push on when I could. And then we got to another point where he, you know, caught up to him and we were together. And I just didn't want to blindly follow him and potentially, you know, that was on the news section. And I didn't want to, blindly follow him and potentially sort of get off where I wanted to be. And so, yeah, he sort of went his way and I went my way. And then, yeah, we saw each other again later. But, yeah.
That takes a confidence to be able to do that, to be confident in yourself.
I guess so. But I think, you know, by that stage, you've probably got to have that confidence to get to that point. So I don't think, you know, anyone on the loop five would have probably done much different.
And I think too, I mean, it's a wise strategy because there's no, this is the thing. Yeah. It's John Kelly, multiple Barclay finisher. He's also been up for God knows how long and is tired. And there's no guarantee that he might not make a crashing navigation error. So
adventure racing, you know, you've had some pretty amazing times doing that. Tell us, I'm particularly intrigued by the Patagonia Expedition race. I think it was 2012.
Yep.
It's pretty insane.
Oh, I mean, it just looked appealing. Like, it was a bit of just luck, really, that I got involved in that. So it was, I'd been doing some Rogaines and orienteering and that sort of thing. And I hadn't done an adventure race before, but my name got passed on to some other people who hadn't done an adventure race before, and they sort of like, would you like to go to Patagonia and do an expedition race there? I was like, oh yeah, it sounds quite good. So it was, yeah, incredibly lucky that these people contacted me, and we got on well and headed over there, and I had a fantastic time racing over there. It sort of potentially ruined my adventure racing though, because it's such a stunning location, and the race is just, I found it magical. So you know, it's a week of racing in wilderness basically. I think, you know, after we started, we saw a few houses or shacks, you just about call them, over the next 7 days, and ended up on the Beagle Channel, like way down in southern Patagonia, and yeah, it was just a fun time with friends really, and yeah, I was really impressed with how well we did considering our lack of experience.
The aspect of adventure racing, and I mean, I guess people, because you aren't out there and so, you know, shouting from the rooftops and so on, people might get the impression that you sort of like being alone. And you mentioned you don't mind spending a time alone, but you also obviously work quite well in those sorts of environments and in those team environments. And of course, the Rogaines are you're pairing up with someone. So what is it about that you enjoy?
I mean, I guess I'm not a person who just wants to be by themselves all the time. I guess I just wouldn't publicly push myself forward. I really enjoy that team aspect, and I found in the Rogaines I've probably done better in the team aspect, like having like a team of two generally. It works very well with a team of four. I've really enjoyed that as well, but I think to get a team of four working really well for an entire race is quite a skill to have. I really enjoyed that aspect of it as well. So it's not just the physical side. It's, you know, how do you motivate people? How do you look after everyone on the team so that team's going as well as they can? Racing with others as well is just, it's great. You know, you sort of see the ups and downs of everyone.
I guess you get to carry each other along. Hey, what do you do when you're not racing and running and training and not doing hill sprints up Port Hills and all those other things that our bad sources told us?
Sleeping.
Kids?
So I work as a software engineer, and I also got three kids, so I spend a bit of time looking after them as well. But between all those things, there's not much free time.
Life's pretty busy.
Yep.
Greg, you have been so gracious to us, and I have... speaking for myself, I'm sure Eugene's thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. We're going to let you off the hook now, but we will leave you with one question that we ask everyone who comes on Dirt Church Radio, and that's, Greg Hamilton, what's been your greatest run ever?
So I'm not going to answer it. I would just say any run that you're out with friends is a great run. It doesn't have to be anywhere in particular. Like, it's just great to be out with friends doing something like running. Anytime you're in the mountains, particularly down here in the South Island, and, you know, you've got a beautiful day and snow on the peaks, it's pretty special. So, you know, if I'm out on the mountains with friends running, that's pretty much the best you can get. But any time with your friends is great.
That's a great run. That is a great run. We'll take that. We'll take that as an answer. Sorry, even though you refused. Look, you gave a shout out to Claire at the beginning. Is there anyone else that you want to, you know, this is your chance. Do you want to thank anyone else?
Who do I want to thank? I mean, there's lots of people. You know, all the people I run with have been is very, very supportive. So it's been really beneficial. And I do have Hawleys have been kind enough to give me product for the last few years, which has been really beneficial for racing. So they've been amazing in that respect. And I really rate their products. So, you know, I was using their products before. So, you know, that's been great. But, yeah, it's the family as well. It's just, can't really say enough about them. It's just amazing.
That is the most New Zealand sponsor ever, Hawleys.
Thank you so, so much. We really appreciate it. And we'll promise we'll leave you alone now.
Thanks.
There we go. What an amazing chat. Thank you, Eugene, and thank you very much to you all out there in podcast land listening to us. We're on social media at Dirt Church Radio. You can email us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com, and don't forget to sign up to the new podcast and newsletter.
Also, don't forget to send in your greatest run ever. It's one of our most favourite part of the shows. We'd love to hear your greatest run ever. And if you want to have a read of them on the website, you can do that. Go and have a look at them, get inspired, think of your own greatest run ever, and send it in to us, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com.
Thanks to our sponsors, Scott Running, Further Faster, Currens, and our Substack subscribers in the DCR Aid Station crew. Stay tuned for our show in 2 weeks when we have another great guest lined up, and check out the DCR Aid Station next week.
Hei kona. Thanks, Rigby.